This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast from Friday, August the 21st, 2020. At BBC Woman's Hour is where you'll find us on social media. And this morning, we've got some really, really good guests. We're talking in a big chunk of the programme towards the end of it today about how we learn to make time for ourselves. How do you do that efficiently without harming maybe the others in your life? Let's just talk about how we can just carve out that bit of time in our day, in our week, to indulge ourselves. Maybe not even indulge, maybe that's the wrong word, but just be ourselves and be in the moment and do the stuff we really enjoy. Our guests on that item include Louise Pentland, best-selling author and mum influencer, somebody who's huge on Instagram, so she's with us this morning. We'll also talk to the brilliant author Wendy Holden, whose new novel is called The Governess, and I really enjoyed this. It's about Marion Crawford, the woman who taught the Queen and was then ostracised by the royal family. Something happened, we'll find out what in the company of Wendy Holden a little bit later in the programme. First, though, we start with this. Earlier this year, Ria, a 16-year-old girl from Shetland, put out an anonymous appeal to anyone who wanted to share their experiences of sexual violence. Within 24 hours, she'd had more than 60 replies. I've been talking to Ria and to Lisa Ward, the manager of Rape Crisis Shetland. First of all, I asked Ria why she'd wanted to do this.
Well, it started during lockdown. I kept seeing a lot of posts on social media of the Me Too campaign. And I was sitting thinking, being up in the island that I am, I don't see a lot that comes from Shetland. So I sat down and I was thinking what I could do to do something up here. And that's when the idea came into my head. And I was originally going to do it just a few people that I knew stories, but I thought that there'd be a lot of other people that would want to share their stories. That's when I decided to put out just the anonymous text message to everyone that responded. And I only expected to get maybe 10 or 15 responses at first. And when half an hour came, I had over 40 responses. And that's when I messaged Lisa Rape Crisis for help.
Did you know Lisa or did you know of her?
Yeah, I am in a volunteer group at Rape Crisis called Bee. Started off as a voluntary group. I was one of the first members, as I've worked with Rape Crisis for quite a while. And it's a group of between 14 to 25, a group of volunteers. And we just work along Rape Crisis and raise awareness and have different things. We'll make, might make posters or have exhibitions or just anything to really raise awareness in Shetland.
Do you feel that in your part of Britain, there's a reluctance to acknowledge the issue, to pretend, in fact, that it doesn't exist at all?
Yeah, definitely. Being in the community that we are, it's quite safe in general, and everyone kind of takes that and brushes anything that they hear about sexual assault or sexual violence, kind of brushes it under the carpet. And if they do hear a story about it, they think that it doesn't happen up here. They kind of brush it to the side because it's such a small community.
The fact that you actually got quite a response, what does that make you think?
It was quite shocking to see, really, because I knew that there would have been a lot more than I expected. But it's how much I got in such a little time. That was quite, I only had the post up for about 24 hours. And within then, I got about 66 responses.
And just to be clear, what did the post say?
It was just asking that, saying that I was going to do a post to raise awareness on sexual violence and asking people to share their stories, and that it would be anonymous, so I wouldn't know, and no one else who was reading the post would know whose story it was.
And obviously the anonymity is really important, but do you know whether the people who responded were women, whether they were young women, whether there were any male contributors?
Well, the age range kind of went from, I think it was 14 right up to 26, and then there was both women and men in the story as well.
And what kind of things were they telling you?
It was a big range. There was people that were saying they were getting groped in the street, or groped in the pubs. There was stories of sexual assault on well-known streets in Shetland, and there was stories of rape. It went, covered everything, really.
It's depressing, Lisa, but obviously you've got to be really naive to think that this kind of thing doesn't go on everywhere. It's unfortunately, it's a fact of life, isn't it?
Yes, well, I wouldn't say that sexual violence is a fact of life in that it's inevitable, but certainly it is very common, much more common than I think the average person is aware of. And in particular, as Ria highlighted, there is kind of a perception that maybe it doesn't happen in smaller rural communities. And that's possibly because there's less visible things like catcalling in the street, for example. You're less likely to see that, but you're as likely to see other forms of sexual violence here, as Ria's shown.
So you weren't surprised by what she discovered, but I guess the real issue is what happens now?
I mean, no, obviously Shetland Rape Crisis, it wasn't a surprise to us to read it, but it certainly was very powerful, and it had a big emotional effect, even though we work with this kind of content day in, day out, seeing all those stories. And in particular, they were clearly from young people. They list ages, and it was quite emotional for the whole team here to read those things and to recognise those patterns of behaviour. In terms of next steps, I mean, there are a number of things we can do to combat sexual violence, and one of them is what Ria's already done. It's breaking those myths and allowing people to be able to pattern spot about what does sexual violence actually look like. No, it's not a stranger waiting in an alleyway with a knife. It's more likely to be someone you know and trust, potentially a partner, potentially someone within your family, and to happen in domestic spaces. And I think that Via's work here has really shown that.
It is depressing. I know that one of the very, very young contributors was only 8, is that right? And talked about being sexually assaulted in a street in Lerwick.
Yes, I believe that's the youngest age that was listed. We do know that childhood sexual abuse is a significant problem countrywide and a problem in Shetland. This past year, around about 40% of the service users that we have seen said that they were first affected by sexual violence under the age of 16. So we know it's an issue, and it's an issue that continues throughout life. But it is possible to heal from it, and it is possible to prevent it as well.
Often on this programme, unfortunately, we have to talk about rape and about the woeful conviction rate. Lisa, what's the situation in Scotland?
I mean, similar to England in that the conviction rate is low. It's slightly different in Scotland in that we have 3 different outcomes that you can get rather than just the 2. So there's guilty, not guilty, and not proven. And not proven is statistically far more likely in cases of sexual violence, sexual assault and rape. So not proven can be a big barrier to any kind of conviction. As well as that, Scotland has corroboration laws, and so acts like sexual violence that tend to happen behind closed doors are very difficult to corroborate. There's usually unlikely to be a witness because that's how the perpetrator has designed it. So again, that adds an additional hurdle in Scotland to conviction.
Well, is there a campaign to do something about that? But let's start with the corroboration. Surely there are people who want that changed.
Yes, there is. And there's been a long-going campaign around corroboration, and a number of groups have added to that and fed back to the justice system about that. And Rape Crisis Scotland and all the associated rape crisis centres, Shetland Rape Crisis included, are a part of the hashtag #EndNotProven campaign as well. And there's a lot of good stats on the Rape Crisis Scotland website about how Not Proven works in Scotland with regards to conviction rates.
Well, I mean, Not Proven is an interesting one, not least to those of us in England who obviously we don't have it in the courts in England and Wales. Are you very concerned that that might actually lead to people who are indeed guilty getting away with it?
Well, we do know it is used disproportionately in rape cases. I think it's something along the lines of 2016-17, only 39% of rape and attempted rape cases resulted in convictions. So that's the lowest rate for any crime. And nearly 30% of those acquittals were not proven, compared with about 17% for all other crimes and offences. So it does remain a big concern.
Yeah, and do juries always understand quite what that means?
I mean, theoretically, yes, they're supposed to, but in practice, no, I don't think that necessarily is understood. It's quite often seen as a way of saying, well, it's hard to prove this thing, but we're kind of believing the victim, but not. So there can be a good intent from a jury picking a not proven verdict, but ultimately it has the same effect as a not guilty. Nothing happens with regards to the perpetrator.
And forgive me, I hope this isn't an ignorant question, but would a rape trial take place on Shetland or would that case be on the mainland?
That depends on the case preparer, essentially. So once your evidence is gathered, the case preparer makes their case and then makes a recommendation as to whether it's sheriff court or high court. We have an advocacy worker. She's quite busy. She works within the courts here, supporting people going through sexual violence, domestic violence and rape cases. The idea is that for more serious sexual crimes, those do go to the high court, but not always.
Right. I mean, that would worry me slightly in terms of getting a fair trial on Shetland with a population of, what, 23,000. Does that worry you?
Yes. I mean, that's one of the unique hurdles within Shetland. I mean, on the plus side, everyone kind of knowing each other, like I say, can add an accountability, so you see less things like street harassment. But in terms of barriers to the justice system, you know, your auntie might work in the police station. Maybe the nurse that's doing your forensics is one of your sister's friends. You are meant to not be a part of the jury if you know anyone involved in the case, which I believe can be very difficult up here for the sheriff court to manage as well. And then we have some really excellent local media who do a lot of really good work with us in terms of coverage of this kind of stuff. But again, it's very high profile. So there's a number of barriers in Shetland to going the justice system route.
Very interesting. That's Lisa Ward, the manager of Rape Crisis Shetland. And you also heard from the very impressive Ria, who is just 16, doing some really good work there. Next week on Woman's Hour, it is Listener Week, which means that everything we talk about has been suggested by you, and a really entertaining range of topics. I've just got the list of stuff we're doing next week in front of me now. Everything from women at a women-only university in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, to grave tending, to getting women paddling, to lady clan chiefs singing in a choir, and whether speaking proper, that's received pronunciation, does genuinely get you more respect. So lots and lots of subjects on next week's programme. Still time for you to suggest something. If you're burning to suggest a topic for us next week, please do email us via the website. On Monday, we're also talking about knits. And actually, I suppose I assumed that because schools haven't really been happening, surely knits have actually died off a bit. Well, maybe they haven't. Maybe they're still being gleefully spread across the nation. Any knit stories for us, any experience of knits, let us know in time for Monday's programme, when we're also talking about everything you ever wanted to know about the pill. Some of you have already mentioned lots of questions for us about menstrual migraines, endometriosis. But again, still time for you to pitch in. If you have a question for Julia Hogan, lead contraceptive and sexual health nurse for Mary Stopes, and Dr. Rebecca French, associate professor of sexual and reproductive health research at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. There are expert contributors on Monday morning's programme when we are talking about the pill. Everything you need to know about it, any questions you want answered about the pill on Monday morning's programme. Now, Wendy Holden is a hugely successful novelist with us now. Good morning to you, Wendy.
Hi, Jane. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Your new novel is called The Governess. It's a fictionalised account of the life of a woman called Marion Crawford, a trainee teacher from Scotland who went into royal service, apparently slightly against her will, and ended up teaching the princesses Elizabeth and Margaret. This is an absolutely fascinating saga, this. I dimly knew the woman's name. I also knew she'd fallen out of favour, but I didn't really know why. So, Wendy, how much of your book is true and how much, frankly, have you plain made up?
Well, I think all historical fiction fills in between the facts. And in writing The Governess, I used my imagination as well as reading every historical source I could lay my hands on. And in doing that, I was looking for clues and using them to build Marion Crawford's character. And as you say, the royal world she so unexpectedly found herself in. But I always had this contrast in mind between this young, sparky woman with her woke ideas and this very traditional institution she entered. So that was always in the back of my mind, this great contrast.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely fascinating. But can we start at the end, actually? Because she was, well, she wrote about the princesses. Her book was, I gather, a somewhat saccharine account of being with them and being around them. It was called The Little Princesses.
Yes.
Why was that so controversial and why did it lead to her being given the elbow?
Well, it was, as you say, it was very loving and very respectful. And unlike other subsequent royal lid lifters, it shows the family, the royal family, in an almost idyllic light. They appear as a really powerful, loving unit. I think the reason it was such a problem for the royal family was that this was the first of its kind. And I think they wished to encourager les autres. I think they wanted to stop people in the future writing anything about the royal family, which obviously went really well and worked brilliantly because no one's ever written a word about them since.
And of course, they, to a degree, invaded their own privacy.
Well, exactly. Absolutely. But there were aspects too. As I say, I mined this book quite carefully for clues. And some of the things I discovered, which were brilliant to fictionalise, were things such as it's possible that the Queen had what we call now a touch of obsessive compulsion, because one of the things about Marion Crawford's story is that she was with the royal family during some really seismic historical events. So the abdication, the coronation of George VI, which was obviously unexpected, and the whole of World War II.
Yeah.
And she saw and experienced all this just as they did, and but in particular from the point of view of the little girls. And some of these events were obviously for them very worrying. And one way Princess Elizabeth tried to cope was by setting her shoes very straight every night and her clothes just so, and getting out of bed in the middle of the night just to make sure everything was still there and everything was still straight. And she also had this collection of 30 toy horses, which she would groom and feed every night before she went to bed. So this, and which is sort of interesting because it shows you the Queen as a vulnerable little girl.
Well, how do we know that happened? And also, I should say, it's not unusual in small children to behave in exactly that way, is it?
Well, I mean, it's in Crawford's book, which seems to be generally based on her real experience. So, and yeah, absolutely. But it was a very good example of, it was a brilliant thing to fictionalise anyway, so, but I'm pretty sure it was true.
Yeah.
The Queen is quite a composed person. She just seemed quite keen on self-control, and this seems to have been, this is the theme in the book, in The Little Princesses, this very sweet child, this very obedient child, this child who was really willing and desperate to please. And it's a very touching portrayal of her, and the relationship between this very formal little girl and this sort of very sort of lively young teacher who come from a completely different world. It's a real, they're a really odd couple, but they fused right from the beginning. They got on right from the start, even though Crawford never expected to like the royal family. And it's that sort of unusual combination that's really at the heart of the book, and which made it so such a dynamic story to fictionalise.
Now, you make Marion Crawford somebody with left-leaning sort of notions, but what?
Yes.
How do you know that, or have you made that up?
That? Yeah, well, I think, as I say, that in the back of my mind all the time I was writing was this contrast between the formal institution of the royal family and this woman who came in into it from the outside. And what's definite about Crawfee is that she was a young student at a time of great political and social upheaval in the 1920s, 30s. And she was of a generation of women that could vote for the first time and train for a career. And most crucially of all, and this is what really drew me into the story right from the start, was on the very first page she tells us, "I never wanted to work for royalty. When I left teacher training, when I finished, when I got my degree, I wanted to work in the slums of Edinburgh. I really wanted to help." So she had a social conscience. She believed in social justice. You know, this is a very unusual. So I thought, how did this woman come from that into royalty, into this very traditional setup?
And
so that
did
was
she
for me.
Did she really make it her business to take the princesses on the underground?
Absolutely.
She did
absolutely.
Do that. We know that.
Completely, absolutely. There were pictures of it. She, when she joined the royal family, she felt she brought all her progressive ideas with her. She thought her pupils were too removed from everyday life and she wanted to take them out to see the real world. So she took them, as you say, on the tube and shopping at Woolworths. And she even started a Buckingham Palace guide pack. So, you know, this is her legacy, in my view. You know, when people say these days that the Queen has great good sense and the common touch, I think that's Crawfee's legacy.
Yes. I mean, it is poignant. And you already mentioned that she was at the heart of some tumultuous events. And of course,
yes.
When she first went to do the job, slightly reluctantly, Princess Elizabeth was not going to be the Queen. And then, of course, the abdication meant that she was, to a degree, saddled with that lifelong responsibility.
And yes, absolutely.
Marion Crawford was pivotal at that time, very pivotal.
Completely. And you know, it's really interesting because she's as you say, she was completely pivotal. But the Queen is one of the world's most successful public figures. She's one of the most famous people in the world. But no one's ever heard of that. And what makes a person like that? You know, what makes a figure like the Queen? And the answer is somebody like Marion Crawford, who was a crucial early influence, but no one's ever heard of her. And for me, that made her such a brilliant subject for a novel. I was looking in an area that no one had ever looked into before and telling a familiar story from a completely different point of view that no one had ever looked into before. So it was, you know, a fantastic opportunity.
Was she treated very unfairly then?
I think she was. It's all very mysterious and, well, slightly confusing as to actually what happened about the little princesses. Because, strangely enough, it seems to have actually begun with Queen Elizabeth, who was the mother of Princess Elizabeth, who wanted some articles about Princess Elizabeth to appear in the American press. This was in the wake of the Second World War. It was in the interest of bilateral relations. And a magazine called the Ladies' Home Journal was picked to carry these articles, and a courtier was chosen to write them. Now, Crawfee, by that time, had left royal service, and she wanted, and she had this slightly dodgy husband who felt that she should write them instead. And he sent her to ask the Queen, and the Queen said no. And Crawfee was happy to shelve the whole thing. But by then, her husband had teamed up with the Ladies' Home Journal editors, who were a pretty unscrupulous couple. And between the three of them, they manipulated her into writing her own version of events. And it seems that she believed that nothing would be published without the Queen's permission. But this wasn't true, and they published it anyway. And it was a huge success, but it was a disaster for Crawfee. He was cut off forever. And they never spoke to her again, and I think she did obviously breach a code of silence. But on the other hand, you know, as I say, there was nothing particularly heinous was revealed. And they never spoke to her again, even though subsequently plenty of things appeared about the royal family. And she must have sat there in Aberdeen, where she'd gone to live, thinking, what was it I did that was so wrong?
And she was actually a very, very unhappy woman. I mean, you could say, I guess, made unhappy by what happened.
I think she regretted it forever, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the other things about her story arc. You know, it begins in as a student in Edinburgh, and then she joins and it's an unexpected success, her relationship with her family and all the taking out into the tube. And then the war comes along, the abdication, the coronation, all the glamour, all the drama. And then and all those things in themselves are amazing. But then to end in this way, with this sort of terrible, tragic ostracism, and there was also a suicide attempt, and she bought a house right by the road to Balmoral. I mean, I've been to see it, and it's amazing. The idea of her standing at the window, watching the royal cars going past year after year, hoping that they'd stop, hoping that they forgive her, but they never did, just seemed to be such a sort of dramatic opening for my novel. Well, that's what I use.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It is incredibly poignant. And again, that's real. She did buy that home.
She
deliberately
bought the house. I've actually been to see it. Absolutely, she bought that house, and she must have bought it for that reason. It's right by the road. She couldn't have missed it. So yeah, that's how she ended her life. And it was 40 years between The Little Princesses being published in 1950 to her death in 1988. And all that time, there was not a word.
And nothing after she died. Nothing. No representation at the funeral.
No, not even a flower. But if there was any doubt about her lifelong loyalty to the family and how much she had loved them and. After she died, in her will, she left a box, a little chest with letters that the Queen and Princess Margaret had written to her over the years. They're bound with faded ribbon, written in a childish hand, all these sort of lovely cards, lovely little jokey things. And she could have sold them any time if she really had been this person who was exploiting her royal service, but she never did. And in her will, she left them to the Queen, and they've gone into the Royal Archives, and whether we'll ever see them again, I don't know. But it just sort of, if there's any doubt, this woman was a completely loyal and completely loving right to the end. That's it. So it's so poignant. It's such a sad story. And yet when she... in her glory years, you know, she really lived. You know, she had a ringside seat at the greatest show on earth. So again, you know, the contrast, the glamour, the drama, the tragedy. I mean,
I bet you couldn't believe your luck when you found nobody else had written this novel, Wendy.
Jane, I couldn't believe it, and I wrote it at sort of warp speed because I was absolutely terrified that somebody else would see it, somebody else would do it, because it seemed to me, you know, I couldn't believe it had never been told before. But one of the reasons was that her story's been buried for so long because she's been ostracised. Most official histories of the period hardly mention her. No. You know, she might feature as a footnote or maybe as a slightly dismissive paragraph, but that's it, you know. And so she's a huge and unexplored area, and so a gift for the novelist. So,
well, buried no more, thanks to you.
Buried no more. I hope not, because, I mean, her story really deserves to be heard.
Just briefly, I mean, we could talk forever, but I gather there is a slight hint of a thaw because she featured in a bit of film, an archive bit of film.
Exactly, she did. When the Queen was 94, there was some material was released and a previously unseen bit of footage, just a few seconds, which shows Crawfee and the little princesses on board a ship dancing the Lambeth Walk, which is sort of very jolly. And it just makes you think, is this a sign that the Queen has realised how much she owes this woman and how unfairly she was treated? And I really hope so, because I think it's the least she deserves.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Really enjoyed the book. It's called The Governess. It's about the life of Marion Crawford, and the author is Wendy Holden. Now, there's been so many portraits of this woman and interviews about her and really quite breathless accounts of celebrities she's influenced. I'm talking about Glennon Doyle, who appeared on Woman's Hour back in May. And just in case you missed it, Glennon Doyle talking about her self-help guide, Untamed. You can find it on BBC Sounds. Just go to BBC Sounds, search Woman's Hour, Glennon Doyle, and you'll hear her talking to Jenny. This is the self-help book that everyone is absolutely just living their life by, apparently. It's about the need to stop pleasing others and start living. Apparently, it's hugely influential and inspiring. And it's not unconnected to our next conversation, which is about how to make time for yourself. It's the next in our how-to series that we've been doing over the summer on Woman's Hour. My guests are Deborah Joseph, the editor of Glamour magazine, Celia Dodd, author of The Empty Nest and Not Fade Away, How to Thrive in Retirement, and the author and parenting vlogger, Louise Pentland. Welcome to all three of you. Really good to have you on the programme. Deborah, can we start with you? Because I think it's fair to say you came the closest to just finding life too much for you. Just give us a glimpse into your life at the time all that happened. What was going on?
Well, hi. Firstly, thank you for having me on. I'm very excited to be here. So I started as the editor of Glamour almost 3 years ago now, and I came on it off the back of maternity leave with my third child. I'd had a year and a half off with my third child, And I came back to a hugely exciting job, but also a massive job. You know, I was taking a print magazine and turning it into a digital 360 brand. And it was really stressful. I wasn't sleeping. Sometimes I was going to work on 4 hours sleep a night. I had terrible guilt about leaving my two-year-old. You know, my kids at the time were 2, 4, and 6. Terrible, terrible guilt. My husband and I were arguing almost every single day for the first 6 months of the job because I felt that my mental load was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed by the idea of pickups and drop-ups, and are my kids safe, and are they making it to clubs properly, and am I there? And I just couldn't cope.
I'm not surprised. You know, I mean, just I'm quite exhausted just hearing about that. To be honest with you, I'm being entirely serious. That was quite a burden. Of course, most people, Deborah, will not be the editor of Glamour magazine. It's a privileged position to be in, as you'd be the first to acknowledge, I'm sure.
Did you
then just have to have a word with yourself and your husband and say, I can't do this anymore?
Well, I really considered giving up my job, to be honest with you. I really, really seriously kept saying to myself, is it worth it? Is it worth it for the arguments? Is it worth it for my children, for my own mental health? And I decided I didn't want to give it up because I absolutely love my job. It's exciting, it's thrilling, and I'm ambitious. And I didn't want to have to make a choice between being a mother and being a career woman. You know, I've always been brought up to believe I can do whatever I want to believe. Sorry, to do whatever I want to do. But also, that was the problem. I've been brought up to believe that failure wasn't an option. And suddenly, I just had a bit of a moment, and I thought, if I'm going to continue doing this, I can't do it all at the same time, and something has got to give. And I just manufactured this concept in my head. I didn't even see a counsellor. I don't know where it came from. It just came to me one day. I just thought, I'm going to start consciously dropping balls and live my best 70% life. And I thought, I'm just not going to live 100% life. I'm going to, you know, 30%. I'm going to decide what's going in my 70%, what's important to me. And the rest, which is the 30%, is just going to have to fall by the wayside.
Okay, that's interesting. It's working.
Yeah, it worked for me. Well, yeah. I'm now 3 years into the job, and I'm definitely not in the same level of anxiety that I was then, no.
All right. Let's bring in Louise. Your top strategies for managing time, Louise. You've got two children, haven't you?
Yes.
And tell me how you operate.
Okay. Hello. Thanks for having me. And also, Deborah, I was smiling through when you said you just consciously decided to drop some balls. I think that's fantastic. And I'm going to try and drop some as well. I'm a list maker, which sounds very basic, but lists for me are like my therapy, because I think as soon as you write everything down and put it on paper or your notes app or wherever you're putting it, it's not swirling around your brain and you don't feel like you've got to hold it so tightly in your brain, and then you get stressed thinking, what am I going to forget? What do I need to do next? Whereas if it's in a list for me, I suppose it's a bit like the 70-30. I can see what's really a priority and I put those at the top, and then all the ones that aren't that important go at the bottom. And if I don't finish the list, that's absolutely fine. And usually I don't. Usually the list gets longer as the day goes on.
And do you deliberately make sure you have got time for yourself, Louise?
I do now, but it's taken me till this long. I'm 35. And twice now I feel like I've been on the very, very edge of being seriously unwell, both physically and mentally, because I've pushed and pushed. Like Deborah said, failure wasn't an option. That's how I felt, because I've always felt like you've got to be your best, give your best, do your best. And sometimes the best thing you can do for yourself and actually your job and everyone around is just take time out. And whether that's going for a bath or going out with a friend for a day or going on a whole holiday and saying, no, I'm not answering anything. If there's a crisis, someone else will just have to deal with it. That's what I do. And I think lockdown as well, as much as it's been slightly hellish, it's also been really positive, because I've thought, oh, look what happens. You can stop the world and get off. And it's not the end of the world if you do that.
No. But you, I think for a couple of years you were a single parent as well. And that is another, well, to put it mildly, can be a real challenge.
Well, there's highs and lows of that. because everything is on your shoulders. And if you drop a ball, it's your response. There's no one else there to pick it up. And so that's very difficult. But again, that's when you find a new support network, and maybe it's not your partner anymore, but maybe it's friends or family, or you just lower your expectations of what you're able to achieve in a day, a week, a month, and then be grateful for what you have done. Yeah, just do your best.
And own what you have achieved rather than being hard on yourself for the stuff you haven't got around to doing,
absolutely.
I guess.
Absolutely. Celebrate the small wins.
Yeah, well, it's just as well I can do that. Celia, you're not yourself retired. I think it's important we emphasise this, but you are somebody who's written very powerfully on the subject of retirement. And I guess in some ways there is an assumption that that is when you have all the time in the world.
Absolutely.
But it's not necessarily true, Celia.
No, absolutely it isn't true. I mean, an awful lot of people who are retired now do actually carry on working. I think there's about 1 million people over 65 are still working. And a lot of people cram their diaries full of all sorts of things. They're doing part-time work, they're volunteering, they're caring either for elderly parents or doing grandchild care. So they're busy. So they need sort of time out in just the same way that hardworking mothers need time out. But there's also retired people who maybe are feeling a bit overwhelmed by they don't know what to do with their time. I mean, that is as much of a problem. Mm. And they need to take time out to work out what they want to do and to find out what their priorities are. Because when you're retired, obviously you feel that time is slipping past and you need to make the most of it, which is another pressure. So life can drift on if you don't actually take time out and work out what you want to do and realise that it's not, you're not being selfish by doing that. People feel so guilty about it, but it's not. It's not a desire, it's a need. You
yeah.
need to do this.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. How do you navigate the slightly complicated waters when perhaps you might be asked to care for younger members of the family and yeah. other people close to you will make the assumption that you have the time?
Well, I think you can say no, but I think you say it in a constructive way. So it's always no but. So if you don't want to do it, or if you, I mean, most people want to help as much as they possibly can within their own, you know, but they want to do their own things as well. So I think it usually is a no but. So you, I think if you can be really constructive about how you could help, so, you know, I don't want to do full-time childcare, but I could certainly help a couple of mornings a week, or I could do this or that. I think that's the way to do it, and to be put, always try and put yourself in the other person's shoes and think how it is for them. And so, you know, you can work out a way together of how things can work
without causing offence. Yeah,
yes, unnecessary. Absolutely. Yeah.
Deborah, what do you prioritise for you?
I mean, it's changed slightly in lockdown. Obviously, when you're commuting 2 hours a day, which I was doing before, there wasn't much time for me at all, and that was the problem. Whereas actually, funnily enough, in lockdown, I've got time to maybe go for a walk at lunchtime, spend time with my kids, do creative stuff with my kids, rather than just, you know, get ready, put your shoes on, which is how I used to be with them. And, you know, sitting and watching Netflix and drinking wine with my husband, I think they're my priorities in life now.
Yes. Okay. How much wine? I mean, we've got to be very careful because.
Well, you know, I do. I like, you know, a glass of Whispering Angel a day doesn't go amiss.
Oh yeah. Oh, I think I've tried that too. It was. I can't drink wine anymore. No one's interested in whether I can drink wine or not. Let's talk about that, Louise. The idea that sometimes just by doing things that are, I mean, I'm going to cause offence here, that a man might take for granted, a woman gets criticised for. I am talking, I suppose, about sporting activities, stuff outside the home that can be really difficult for women to get to.
Yeah, do you know, I had this conversation with my partner the other day. We have a lovely little village pub, and he quite often will, on the way back from the shopping, pop in and just have a pint and just, I don't know, look through his phone, chat to people. And I said, I never get to do that. And he was like, but you can if you want. And then I thought, he's right. If I really wanted to, on the way back from the supermarket, I could go to the pub. I just never, ever think to do that. And I think, I want to believe that we all live in an equal world, but I just feel like as a woman, I would never just go and sit in a pub and have a drink and flick through my phone, because I think, right, got to get home, got to get the shopping in the freezer, got to get dinner on, got to do this, got to do that. But perhaps we should all, you know, take a leaf out of men's books, because they've got the right idea. He comes home really relaxed from the supermarket yeah. every time.
Of course, and he is right. There is nothing to stop you. But
yeah, there's not. He's not stopping me.
No.
It's me.
Yeah, well, that yes. Okay, let's put that to Celia. Why doesn't Louise just sit down and have a half in the pub? Why not?
Well, I think, you know, there were a lot of people and women in my book, actually, the same, you know, they felt they should be washing the floor all the time or, you know, doing something sort of worthwhile. And I think the woman in my book just gave herself a really good talking to. And she said, and she made herself sit down, read a book in the afternoon. You know, reading a book in the afternoon seemed so selfish and terrible, but she made herself do it. And then it became a habit. So I think maybe giving yourself a good talking to and sort of really thinking, yeah, well, why aren't I doing this? And if it is possible, then just get on and do it.
Yes. And Deborah, what about you?
I mean, I'm very happy to read a book in the afternoon if I can do. And I've got two dogs. I love walking them as much as I can. So I've become much more selfish with my time, actually. I'm fully willing to take time out.
But can I just stop there? Is it selfish? It's not really selfish, is it? It's you looking after yourself and you need to be there for everybody else.
You're absolutely right. It's about putting yourself first. Beforehand, it was my kids first, then my husband, then myself. And now I definitely am in with where their level is at in my life, for sure.
Yeah, and you don't mind saying that, and you don't... Do you think other people, other women, I guess, might judge you for that? I'm not suggesting I would, but...
I think people judge, you know, there's all kinds of judgments going on. You know, women, there's all kinds of judgments around working women. I've been judged for that. I know some of my friends are judged for not working.
Yep.
I think you can't really worry about what other people think. That was very much part of my 70% life rule. I am just not going to think about what anyone else thinks of me. All I'm going to focus on is what's important to me, and that's what my focus is. Because I think once you start taking on other people's opinion of yourself on top of your own guilt and on top of your own issues, I mean, you just don't get out of bed in the morning. I just can't live like that anymore.
No, I mean, Louise, you've put yourself front and centre, and much of your life is public, and I guess that must make some people feel that they can tell you exactly what they think about you. That can't be easy.
Oh yes, that's the absolute joy of the internet there, that thinks that they can have an opinion on absolutely everything. But I think that, you know, I'm an adult and I can decide what I take on board, and I have confidence that I'm a good person doing my best. So I try to block out those sorts of things. And if it's a really bad day and I don't block them out, then there's always chocolate.
Well, there certainly is. Can I just put my knit theory to you, since we're talking about knits on the programme next week, on Monday, in fact? I mean, I'm assuming that knits, my kids are older now, but have knits just died off a bit in lockdown?
We have been very fortunate, I'm touching wood, not to have had knits yet. But Darcy's at school and Pearl will be at school in a couple of years, so I'm sure we'll have it. But so far, so good. Touching wood.
OK, we're all looking for the positive spin on lockdown. And mine is today that perhaps knits have been sent packing. Deborah, anything to add to that?
Let's hope so. I mean, we've also been lucky. We've never had them in this house. But, you know, it's just part of being a mother, isn't it? It's just another thing to enjoy in life.
Thank you all very much. Celia, just a quick word from you as our more senior contributor. In other words, you're around the same age as me. Do you think that mothers in particular now have it harder than 20 years ago?
Yes, I think they do, actually. I think there are so many pressures now. I think social media has put another, you know, added pressure on people. But I think, the need to be perfect is getting more and more, and the need to do everything well, to look good as well, which I don't think we felt quite so much 20 years ago. All of these pressures to have the perfect everything, I think, has got much more, and to have the perfect, you know, have perfect children, to bring your child up well. Obviously, we all want to do all of these things, but I do think the pressure has increased. Yes.
I think
and it's easy to feel overwhelmed by all this stuff.
And you heard there from Deborah Joseph, from Louise Pentland and from Celia Dodd on Woman's Hour. Now, Liz in Nottingham tweeted to say, I thought that was interesting, but I always wonder when and why did we choose to work so hard? Very often we place these pressures on ourselves and they live in our heads, she says. Yep, probably quite right. Martina says, holy moly, Jane. Oh, Martina, language, please. Normally I'm happy just shouting back at the radio when I disagree, but your guest today has peed me off. You asked if women have it harder today than 20 years ago and she said yes. I think that's a load of cobblers. 20 years ago, my youngest was one. I had a 5-year-old and a 14-year-old stepdaughter. My husband travelled extensively with his job and I kept the house going, did the school runs, had my own job, so many balls in the air all the time. The difference now is that self-care is considered okay. Then it was considered selfish. It's fine for career women and mothers to execute self-care now, but it wasn't a thing 20 years ago. That's why 20 years ago, I think it was much harder. Martina, thank you for that. Catherine says, commenting on today's item, in my opinion, women never could have it all. Speaking as a now retired working woman with three lovely sons. Alison says, I'm enjoying agreeing with the guests on Time for Yourself. I want to say it's so important to do it, also to role model to your own children that mum isn't the one always slogging away while dad can go to the pub. Yeah, I thought what Louise said about the pub was really interesting, because the truth is, I don't think I've ever been to the pub on my own in my life. But why don't I just occasionally go to my local pub, have a drink and then go home? I don't know why I don't. Christine says, I think heavy pressures have always been part of a mother's life, but the feelings of being overwhelmed and expectations of perfection come from different directions. For my mum, back in the 50s, pressures came from society's expectations of perfectly behaved children and relative poverty to find enough money to clothe and feed them. No phones or social media to seek connections and advice and support. Social media, it has its knockers, but on the other hand, it can also be a huge help to people. Jessie says, totally understand where these women are coming from. A positive from lockdown is learning to take a break without any guilt. Back on going to the pub, Kay says, I don't think it's only women stopping themselves nipping in the pub. There is societal judgment as well. And another listener on the same subject, I feel uncomfortable stopping in the local cafe on the way back from school, never mind the pub, because it's almost always entirely populated by men in the morning. Okay, let's see, what else have we got here? Knits, yes, there's some knit chat. Oh, Marion Crawford, let's deal with the email on Marion Crawford from a listener who says, I know all about this woman, and I assume that most Scottish people do. In the piece, that was from June, and Leslie says, in the piece about Marion Crawford, Jane called her the woman you haven't heard of. Well, actually, she was quite famous in the 1940s, 50s and even later. We heard a great deal about her. Maybe Woman's Hour should rely a little more on the memories and experience of older people. You make a very good point, but I imagine for the bulk of our audience, it wouldn't be a name that they'd know particularly well. But I absolutely take your point. Knits. Christine in Edinburgh is a mum to two little girls, 6 and 7. She says, I almost threw the knit comb out during my lockdown clear out. My little people were in school 2.5 days when we got our first, I'm guessing of many, knit alert emails from the school. How has that happened so quickly, says Christine. Yes, I mean, that reminds me, of course, that Scottish schools are back. And it is interesting, within 48 hours, the knit letter had gone out. Avril says, I'm a retired primary school teacher and I'm thoroughly fed up with telling people that we do not keep pots of head lice in school to distribute among our pupils. Head lice come into school from the community. I'm sure there are lots of people with head lice. They are just less visible now the schools are closed. Yeah, my theory is just going nowhere, is it? From Felicity, in the Isle of Man, we stopped social distancing back in June and children all did 5 weeks of school with no restrictions. I have 3 children and 2 nephews, and by July, they all had head lice again. The true cost of life with no social distancing, maybe, asks Felicity. From Hannah, I can't believe that the 2 mothers you spoke to haven't had knits yet. Yes, I mean, I've got to say, I was a bit surprised by that too, and I will happily say that my kids seem to have knits for basically about a decade. I think we were a knit household. I never had knits as a child in Hampshire, says Hannah, but bringing up 3 children in Somerset, I couldn't comb my daughter's hair in the morning before playgroup, only to comb it after playgroup and find 20 knits every single day. And I catch them from my children. I've got long hair. So with ages 6, 3 and 2, it was constant for 2 to 3 years. Going to stay with friends was awful, as I was always worried about passing them on, which only led to a sense of isolation as a single parent. Oh, Hannah, I'm sorry to hear that you felt that way. She does say she's very happy now. It's no longer an issue, as my oldest is 18. We'll end with one more on knits from Anne. It would be wonderful if COVID has indeed led to the demise of head lice, saving families a fortune on treatment, not to forget the frustration they cause. My doctor, though, did give me a great tip last year. Leave conditioner on your hair after washing. Apparently the conditioner stops the eggs fixing to the hair strands. Right, OK, thank you very much indeed for interacting with us this morning. We're back, of course, tomorrow with the Highlights of the Week edition on Saturday afternoon and in podcast form as well. And then it's Listener Week on the programme next week. If you're listening to the podcast, you will get additional material every day, of course, because you're special. But it's all about you next week. Everything on the programme designed by you and suggested by you.
Are you still there? Good. There's someone I want you to meet. Their name is Sean, they're 16, and they're in trouble. Follow Sean's journey by subscribing to Power Up on BBC Sounds. The world is dying. It's time to take action.
Power.
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 Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.